Dedicated to defending the historic Christian faith. I am your host, H.C. Felder, and today the topic is a critical look at early Islam. And to discuss this with me, I have Dr. Daniel
Janosik.
Let me tell you about Dr. Daniel Janosik. He has a BA from William & Mary. He has a master's from Columbia International University. He has a Master of Divinity from Columbia International University. He has a PhD from London Society of Theology. He's director of the Institute of Islamic Studies, and he's associate professor of apologetics at Southern Evangelical Seminary, as well as the director of online studies. Welcome to the show, Dr. Janosik.
Thank you, Harold. This is great. I really have been looking forward to this. I wanted to mention that this summer, I will have my 30th anniversary with my wife, Anne.
All right.
So we will be married 30 years. We have a daughter, Anna, who just finished graduating from USC down in Columbia.
Uh-huh,
so it's really been a very busy time with all those things happening, but it's been good. I'm glad to be here. I'm glad to be up with Southern Evangelical Seminary, and it's been a great experience so far.
Just to give the audience a little background how I came about this, I'm actually working on my doctorate degree And I took a course, online course, History of Islam, and I just learned so much stuff. It was fascinating. Mm-hmm. It was challenging.
It was very challenging.
I'm glad I did not take any other classes at the time because I would have been in big trouble. But I learned a whole lot. I feel like I got totally immersed in Islam, and I feel like I know a lot more now. Well, and I'm able to dialogue and talk about it and to just go gung-ho now.
Yeah, well, I've spent the last 12, 13, 14 years studying Islam, and I feel like I'm just scratching the surface in many ways.
Right, right.
But it's a very worthwhile area to understand today.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of misunderstanding.
I had no idea how much there was to know. I had no idea about the history and just all of the things that were involved in it. I felt like, you know, drinking from a fire hose, but I'm done now. So we're going to talk about it now. We're going to talk about, because I wanted to share with other people what I learned.
Okay.
And of course, I can't encapsulate the entire course, but we're going to try and do a high level overview of some of the things that I thought are just very, very beneficial to the average person to know.
Sure.
And one thing I definitely want to focus on is contrasting traditional Islam with what we see in actual historical Islam,
right.
What Muslims say, but what the actual evidence says.
Right.
And so I guess the first thing I want to talk about is, I guess the first person we should talk about is Muhammad. Could you give us a traditional view of Muhammad first?
Sure. The traditional view is what you will find in almost any biography of Muhammad. And there are certain things that will always be said. Muhammad was the prophet of Islam, the final prophet of the Judeo-Christian Islamic tradition, as they put it, because they will include Judaism and Christianity as part of their development, Islam being the final say-so, and Muhammad being the final prophet. So they put him back to the year 570 for his birth in the city of Mecca in Saudi Arabia, a city that was supposedly a crossroads of the trade routes of that time. So there was a lot of activity. There was a lot of interchange. There were a lot of people who went through. And this was the place of the Kaaba, the black cube box, where at that time there were 364 or 360 different gods representing all the different nations. And so people would come there to worship those gods. And that's where Muhammad is said to have been born, according to the traditional view, 570, in the family group of the Quraysh, who were the ruling family of the city of Mecca. And so he would have grown up with a lot of things given to him, but his father died before he was born. His mother died shortly after, within 6 years, so he was raised by relatives. And he then went on as a worker on a caravan. He met and worked for a widow named Khadija. She was 15 years his senior. When he was 25, he married her, so she would have been 40. But that gave him a life of ease, and so he was able to then go off and think about life. And it is said that when he was 40 years old, he was in a cave where he rested from the cool, in the cool coolness of the dark in the cave, especially in the Saudi Arabian desert sun outside. He would find relief there, and while he was in there, he had a revelation, or he had an experience, an encounter with what he thought at first was a demon, but was later revealed to him as the angel Gabriel. And Gabriel was trying to bring a message to him from the god Allah. And this message was given to him in many different forms through the next 23 years, and it developed into what we know as the Quran. But Muhammad had a hard time. He was told by this voice, by this angel, Gabriel, to deliver this message to the people. So he went out and he was warning them, repent, or you will face the fires of hell. Right. So a very similar message that Jesus had and John the Baptist had at the very beginning of their ministry. And only a few people listened to him in Mecca. So he had a rough time. Eventually, he ruffled enough feathers that there were some who wanted to get rid of him. So in 622, it is said that he had been invited to a city 200 miles north, Yathrib, which became the city known as Medina, the city of the Prophet. And so he escaped to that city, and that escape is called the Hijra. And that is the day of the beginning of the Islamic calendar, I think July 21st or July 16th, 622 AD. And so all their calendars will go from that date of his escape from the city of Mecca. There in Medina, he had a much greater welcome. People listened to him. He became the mayor, the ruler. He had his followers come. He had more and more people convert to Islam according to the traditional view, and he had gained a lot of power. But they were poor. The people of Medina were a lot of Jewish tribes, farming community, orchards and stuff like that. They didn't have that much. So this is when Muhammad went on different raids, raiding the caravans that he used to lead, mostly the caravans of the Meccans, the ones who had, you know, kicked him out of the city. Right. So this was perhaps a way of paying back and also paying their bills, so to speak. And so they did that for a number of years, and the Meccans tried to put some armies together to come up against them. They were defeated or they were just waited out. One battle was called the Battle of the Trench, where Muhammad and his men dug a trench between the two mountainous areas around Medina. That was the entrance part, so they dug a big trench so that the Meccans could not get across. The Meccans were stuck there for a month or so. They didn't have enough food for their camels and horses, so eventually they left. Not much was done, but the Muslims, or the followers of Muhammad, claimed a victory. Well, through that, he gained power and a lot more followers, so that within 10 years of his time of moving there, he went down to Mecca. First time, they wouldn't let him in because he wanted to do the Hajj, the pilgrimage, mm-hmm. which was part of their own tradition at that time.
Now, is this to worship the pagan gods?
That is usually, at that time, in the traditional view, that's what the Meccans would do. They would come and they would worship their particular gods. But Muhammad was proclaiming that there is only one God. Right. His name was Allah. And Allah was one of those gods, but he said that's the only God. All the other ones are false gods. So he wanted to come and give honor to that one God. And they wouldn't let him come the first time. They made a treaty with him and said, okay, you can come the next time, next year. But he came the next year with 10,000 men. And the treaty, he said, had been broken by a Meccan, so he had some clout on his side. to come in and say to the Meccans, okay, I've got my army, I'm going to come in and, you know, decimate you unless you bow down to my God. So they surrendered the city to Muhammad at that time. Shortly after that, though, he died just a few years later in Mecca after doing all this, and it was his followers who really picked up and spread Islam to the rest of Arabia and then into the Middle East.
Now, that is the traditional story.
That's the traditional story. Muhammad being born in 570, dying in 632, and having married Khadija. She died, and he then married about 10 and 11, 12 different wives after that. The youngest being Aisha, who was betrothed to him at the age of 6. The marriage was consummated at the age of 9. And that is in their own sources, their own hadith, that they recognize that.
Okay, now compare that with the historical view, because what are the sources for these? I mean, how do we know that these things actually happened?
That's the interesting part, because everything that I've just told you about Muhammad does not have one bit of evidence historically at that time from contemporary writers. We get that story from almost 200 years later. The earliest biography of Muhammad is one that was written by Ibn Ishaq, who died in 787. That's about 150 years after Muhammad's death. But we don't have the story even from Ibn Ishaq. We have what he wrote in a what is called a recension by another author, Ibn Hisham, who wrote about 820. So, in other words, the only reason that we know anything about Ibn Ishaq and what he supposedly wrote was that Ibn Hisham said, well, this is what Ibn Ishaq has written, and I am going to give you a lot of his stories, and so on. So historically, or through documents, written documents, the earliest we can go back to the earliest of the biographies would be 200 years after Muhammad's death, 632. 820. So that really is difficult when you realize that there are no Muslim sources that mention Muhammad outside of the Quran. Now, they're going to come back to the Quran and say, and we'll get to that.
Right.
But they're going to say, well, Muhammad is mentioned 4 times in the Quran and he's mentioned in these other places. But we'll see that really there isn't the evidence, especially for the story of Muhammad that is given in any traditional biography of Muhammad. We do not have the sources from that time to give evidence to that.
This is fascinating, and one of the reasons I find it fascinating is because I compare this to Christianity, where we have Roman historians, where we have Jewish historians who are corroborating the gospel message, the gospel story.
Right.
And they are contemporaries of the people that they're reporting on, whereas we have someone, we don't know anything about Muhammad until 200 years, something written 200 years after the fact. We don't know what happened.
Yeah, it's interesting too, because historians, I think it was Renan, probably in the late 1800s, and then other Muslim scholars today reiterate this, that they say, well, Muhammad was born in the full blossoming of history, the full knowledge of history. Well, that's not true when we look at the historical stories. In fact, there are a number of books that are coming out. In fact, one was just released yesterday by Amazon, and it's a history of early Islam by a British historian named Tom Holland. It's a book that I ordered a while back, and I'm waiting for it to come. I've already read the first chapter online at Amazon, but it's by Tom Holland. It's called Under the Shadow of the Sword. Under the Shadow of the Sword. Tom Holland is a respectable historian. The reviews that have come out in a number of papers, and my daughter was relaying one from the Wall Street Journal that just came out on this book. And Tom Holland, in his book, shows that the story of Islam, the traditional view, is not what history tells us.
Right.
He will reiterate what we have just said, that the sources are not there. That he, in fact, says that Muhammad probably didn't even live in Mecca, but he was probably born closer to Jordan or upper up near Syria.
Right.
And that goes back to some earlier historical work that Patricia Crona of Princeton University did probably in the late 70s and early 80s. Well, that's resurfacing. Why? Because the evidence keeps pointing back to a totally different story.
Right.
Now, what we know about Muhammad has come from non-Muslim sources. So there are a few things that, if I might mention.
Yeah, sure.
For example, around 634, supposedly 2 years after Muhammad died, there was a writing, a document that was written by a Nestorian Christian. It's called the Doctrina Jacobi. And he mentions that, quote, a false prophet has appeared among the Saracens and is proclaiming the advent of the anointed one who is to come. So many say, well, this false prophet or this prophet is Muhammad. Well, there's no name given to this prophet.
Right.
And there are a lot of different prophets, a lot of different Messiah figures at
right.
that time.
Right.
And a number of them even called themselves Muhammad. It was a popular name in that latter period of the 600s. And we know of one in the 680s who was actually an enemy of the caliph at that time, the leader of the Muslims at that time, and he was known as Muhammad. In fact, there were some coins that were coined in 687 that were referring to him. So
okay.
we have that name, and it's also very interesting to know that Muhammad means praised one. So another example of where Muhammad is mentioned is on the Dome of the Rock. So we have a time. We know it was built around 691. This is 65 years after Muhammad was died. And the Dome of the Rock mentions Muhammad as a prophet. There is only one God, Allah, or there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. But this particular book here, The Hidden Origins of Islam, edited by Karl Heinz Ohlig, makes the claim that that name, Muhammad, just means praised one.
Right.
And in that context, which was still very much a Christian context, these followers of this religion, which was at this time not really Islam as we know it today, were pulling together a lot of Christian and Judaic type of traditions, and they were praising the one who is to be praised, Christ. So when they're referring to Muhammad, they're referring to the praised one. Now, I still have trouble with that because of other things that were happening at that time. It's a very interesting comment on the
right.
name Muhammad. And then there is Thomas the Presbyter around 640, and he may be the first one to mention Muhammad by name. He says that there was a battle, quote, battle between the Romans and the Arabs of Muhammad, or the Dayaye de Mamet, in Palestine, which was 12 miles east of Gaza. But that the name, again, was a fairly common name. And if it means praised one, we have to wonder about this particular thing. This was a document written by a non-Muslim. It mentions the name Muhammad. But when we look at another document of 690, one written by this guy John Nikiu, about an advance of these Arabs on Egypt, and he says that he mentions in this document the name Muhammad about 92 times. But, I'm sorry, the name Muslim 92 times.
Okay.
But in, and he also mentions Saracens and Ishmaelites, some of the other names that were used. The reason I bring this up is that here we have something that supposedly was written in 690, but the earliest copy we have is one that is written down in 1602 A.D.
Wow.
That is, almost 1,000 years
right.
difference or
right.
or later. And it's in Ethiopic, so it's an Ethiopic copy of an Arabic copy of a Greek document. So we don't have any of those originals.
Right.
What I'm saying is that there are often times where the later copies of different books, and we do the same thing, really substitute words. So when I talk about Muhammad in the early years, and I say, okay, when he was in Medina, the Muslims, they didn't use that term of themselves.
Right.
In fact, Fred Donner, who's an historian in Chicago, University of Chicago, came out with his book, Muhammad and the Believers, at the origins of Islam. And he says they didn't call themselves Muslim. They called themselves Mu'minin, the believers.
Right.
Believers in what? An intermediate type of monotheism. And that I'll get into a little bit later.
Okay.
So we have a lot of question marks that history shows us.
The same thing with the Quran. We have question marks there. What's the traditional view?
Of the development of the Quran?
Yeah.
Well, of course, this would be the revelation of Allah. Mm-hmm. It's supposed to be perfect in every way, and it was given perfectly to Muhammad through Gabriel. It's interesting that Muhammad does not get it directly from God. He gets it through a secondary source,
right.
Gabriel, or as he goes into these different trances sometimes. Sometimes he's asleep and he wakes up and he has this dream. So it comes to him in different forms. But it's supposed to be the perfect word of God, of the revelation that is written on an eternal tablet in heaven, exactly as we have it today in Arabic in the Quran. So Arabic would have to be the eternal language,
right,
according to this view.
Right.
So Muhammad supposedly was illiterate. He did not read or write. So he had to memorize what Gabriel was saying to him. And so he'd go away and he would then recite it to those followers he had, and they would have to memorize it. So you have all these people memorizing it. In fact, that is one reason we may have for a number of years a number of variations of these fragments that we find of Quranic scripts or Quranic-like scripts. But the traditional view says that when Muhammad died, the Quran was not written down as a document. There were some phrases or parts on pieces of wood and bone and other things that they had. They didn't really have paper or the use of leather so much. They were not writers.
Right.
They were an oral tradition. So the traditional view says that there were just these scattered parts. And so as these ones who had memorized the Quran were dying off in battle, the leaders at that time said, we need to preserve this. So 20 years after, in the time of Uthman, one of the leaders, the caliphs, they say in the traditional view that they wrote it down, they checked it out, they burned all the ones that didn't come up to par, that were not consistent with this particular one, and that this became the word of God that the Muslims believe is the same one that we have today. If you take out a Quran and it's in Arabic, it should be the same thing.
Right.
That's what they believe. That's a traditional view.
Well, it's sort of easy to do that if you burn all the other copies, but go ahead.
Yes.
Now, that's the traditional view. Now, what evidence do we actually have for that? What do we actually have evidence for?
Well, first of all, as I mentioned, the Arabs at that time had an oral language. They did not really write things down. If they had to write things down for legal purposes, they used Greek, which was the government over them at that time, Byzantine Greek, and they used Syriac, which was the liturgical or religious language of that time. So they used other languages, and we find earlier records of Arabic sayings that are written in Syriac, for example, using Syriac letters, because the Arabs did not have their own written form at that time. And I've done some extra study in this area. It's fascinating because you see fits and starts of experimental Arabic during this time. This is also the time, you know, 6th century, where Hebrew picked up its vowel markings.
Right.
You know, Hebrew, which is a Semitic language, the same as Arabic, same as Syriac, only had the consonants written down.
Right.
And so the vowel sounds had to be memorized or known from the context. But it's in the 6th century that the Masoretes, the Masoretic Jews, started a system of putting dots and certain symbols to give the vowel sound so that you could read and know exactly what was being said.
Right.
Well, this was also the time when Arabic was being experimented with because they needed a form, a written form, especially as this religion grew. And so it seems like it wasn't until the early 700s and that's 70, 80, 90 years after Muhammad's death, that you would have a form of Arabic that was written down with the dots so right. that you could tell what the vowel sounds were, so that you could have a correct copy of the Quran. And this is testified by the fact that the two copies of the Quran, the old manuscripts that are put forth as the original, as the Uthmanic script,
right.
The Topkapi and the Samarkand, they're both in a Kufic script, which is a later script, from the region of Iraq, and that's more toward the Abbasid period. But these two are dated at 790 or later. Well, that's almost, again, 170, 180 years after Muhammad's death, 160 years after Uthman supposedly wrote those texts. They are dated much later. We do have some fragments of Quranic-like sayings from the find at the mosque at Sana'a in Yemen. Mm-hmm. 1972, they found all these moldy pieces of parchment and papyrus up in the attic of a mosque, and they were going to throw them away. They found out that they were fragments of old Qurans. And one German guy, Gerd Puin, who is also in this book, The Hidden Origins of Islam, he was one of the scholars who studied those for 35 years. And his assessment is that these were the earliest of the Quranic-like sayings, but there are a lot of differences, a lot of variances. And the Muslims cannot accept that because right. they have to have the original
right.
From the 20 years after. So what history is showing is that the Quran, as we have it, went through a lot of changes.
It was not dictated word for word.
It was not dictated.
As Muhammad, or as tradition says.
Right. And what is condemning about that is that if this is something that's gone through a lot of changes, not only changes, but borrowings from a lot of other sources.
Yeah.
And maybe I can mention some of those.
Oh, yeah. That's what okay. I found fascinating in this class when I was studying about the different sources. That, and it's pretty obvious, too. I mean, it's not, it doesn't even sound like it's even debatable.
Right. Some of those sources would be from Syriac Christian Liturgy. It's interesting, a man named Christoph Luxemburg. It's his pseudonym, but he's a scholar in this area, knows Arabic fluently. He's from the Middle East. But as he has studied, he also is a scholar in Syriac, early Syriac. He took verses from the Quran, and he was one who realized, and he's getting this from Muslims, Arabic scholars, who will also say the same thing, that one-fifth or 20% of the Quran is pretty much not understandable, even by Muslims. So they'll get to that verse, and it doesn't fit into what was being said before. It doesn't have context or consistency. So often the commentators will say, well, only Allah knows
okay.
what this is supposed to say.
Okay.
So they will point out that 20% of this really doesn't make sense. But Christoph Luxemburg took some of those verses. He said, wait a minute. My thesis is that a lot of these were transliterated from Syriac liturgy, Christian liturgy, into Arabic, you know, perhaps even before the time of Muhammad, because Syriac was the language of theology in that area. So, and he took some of those Arabic verses, because Arabic and Syriac come from the same root, Aramaic, and he translated them back into Syriac, and it made much more sense.
Mm.
The context made sense. Mm. Well, there's something there. But you don't. Not only do you have that, you have other sources of the stories, because the Quran has a lot of stories from
right.
biblical sources, but they're different. They've been Arabized. And you have some of these stories that are, let's see.
And you have apocryphal accounts of Jesus, of a lot of different things. I think one of the ones that sort of really, really got me was the one where it was so obvious that it was plagiarized, because mm-hmm. they actually plagiarized the comments of the commentary. There was a commentary on
oh, right,
the story,
right.
and whoever copied it copied the commentary.
Yes. Found the part that I wanted to mention. There are, you mentioned the Jewish Targums or the Midrash, which they were commentaries from the Jews, and One of the instances that I think you're mentioning, that you're referring to, is the story of Cain and Abel.
Right.
And Cain killed Abel, so it gives that biblical description. But in this story, in the Quran, there is a crow who is scratching on the ground. And that's how Adam finds out that his son Abel has been buried there in that spot. And they see the blood, seeping out. But that crow is not mentioned, of course, in the biblical account. It's mentioned in one of these commentaries. That's
right.
Brought into the Quran. But that commentary wasn't written until, 4th, 5th century A.D., after Christ.
Right.
So you have that. You have local poetry of Arab poets that are found in the Quran. And Greek legends. You have the Alexander story, which was written about Heraclitus. It was kind of linking him with Alexander the Great. Heraclitus was the emperor of the Byzantines at that time. And in this story of Alexander, which was written probably around 628, 4 years before Muhammad supposedly died, it's a poetic account of this hero going north and south and east and west and trying to find the ends of the earth. That's in the Quran. Why is that poem attributed to Heraclitus, a Byzantine poem,
right,
in the Quran, if the Quran is an eternal book?
Yeah.
So you have a number of those different stories.
I think another thing that really fascinated me was the fact that some of these passages in the Quran were so specific to exactly what was going on at the time in the life of Muhammad.
Oh, yes.
Yes, it was supposed to be an eternal book,
right,
from all eternity,
yeah,
yet it's telling him how to deal with his brother-in-law, just weird,
right,
stuff.
Right, you mentioned Zayd, his son-in-law.
Son-in-law, that's what it was.
He adopted this man because he didn't have any sons. So he's adopted Zayd. Zayd married a woman, Zaynab, who was very, very pretty. And apparently they didn't get along too well, so the story goes. And Muhammad, upon visiting Zaynab one time, when she was in a state of disarray or semi-undress, thought, wow, this is a very beautiful woman. Well, he convinced Zayd to divorce his wife Zaynab, and then after a time, Muhammad married Zaynab.
Right.
Well, that is in the Quran.
Right.
Why is something like that, where the Muslims say, well, this is Allah telling Muhammad what to do about adopting sons and that the fathers, adoptive fathers, can marry the daughter-in-law of an adopted son, and so on. It's just a wild stretch of what was going on.
Yeah.
Why would that be in an eternal book for eternal purposes,
right,
and have such an insignificant little purpose?
I think Aisha said something that tickles me when she said, it's amazing how Allah always rushes to your defense with a passage or something to that effect.
Right, right. Very convenient.
That
with Joseph Smith, too,
yeah,
of the Mormons.
Right.
When
right.
he's writing and putting these things in the Doctrines and Covenants. Very convenient.
Right.
So we find some similarities there.
Now, could you give us a high-level overview of the history of the spread of Islam?
Yeah, this is central. This is very central because we have a traditional view.
Right.
We know historically that within 100 years, this new religion just took over the Middle East, North Africa, went into Spain, kept hold on part of Spain up until the 16th century. Quite a feat for any army,
and right,
especially this small army of Arabs. But we find out that when we look at it historically, that there were some very different historical things going on than what we get in the traditional view. For example, several of these Donner and Quinn and the Hidden Origins. I have a book here by a man named Robert Hoyland, Seeing Islam as Others Saw Islam. He gives the account of the non-Muslims at that time and what they saw. And my dissertation that I did was on John of Damascus, first apologist to the Muslims. He actually lived within the first 100 years. What they're all saying is that it seems like Islam came about as kind of an intermediate monotheism. In that area, they had the Jewish traditions and the influence. They had the Christian influence, but they had more heretical Christian influences of those who looked at Jesus and his nature differently than the Orthodox view,
right,
the Nestorians and the Monophysites. And so there were, and why were they there? Because they had been pushed out to the edges of society, and that's where they ended up, and that's where they flourished and were accepted. But these ideas were coming together, and there were a number of apocalyptic preachers in Arabia at that time. And so they believed that Muhammad was perhaps one of these apocalyptic preachers who was preaching a message of repent, coming back to God,
right,
and becoming more moral, putting aside all these sins. And so he gathered a following, but it was a following not only of Arabs, but also of these Byzantines, and they had power at that time. But what really triggered a lot of what was going on, we talk about 622 as the beginning point, the Hijra,
right,
supposedly when Muhammad left Mecca to go to Medina. But it's more likely that that was a time that the Byzantines pulled out of that area,
right,
and they had the Arab forces as part of their patrol, part of what are called the federati in Italian verbiage for those groups of indigenous soldiers who would guard a place. So these federati were being paid by the Byzantine army to keep watch, because the Byzantines were at war with the Persians next door.
Right.
And this was the battleground. And so they had these patrols of Arabs guarding. But when the Byzantines decided, we've been at this too long, we've got to pull back, so they pulled out of that area. And so these Arabs who had been paid by the Byzantines were no longer paid. They needed to have a money source, and the trade was not enough. So that's probably why you had a number of these groups raiding caravans.
Right.
It was a lucrative way of gaining money. And so Muhammad is, even in the traditional stories, even in Isaac, in the earliest big biographies, you have all these stories of Muhammad raiding the caravans and getting the booty and having slaves and things like that. So the historical sources, and Tom Holland does a great job with this in his book, Under the Shadow of the Sword, in showing that there was a slow growth. And these Arabs and other people who joined them, and some of them were Christians. Some of these were heretical Christians who went up against the Syrians. And the Syrians at that time, those who lived in Israel, the Christians in that group, in that area, were vulnerable. Why? The Byzantines had pulled out.
Right.
So now these towns were ripe for the picking. And so these groups came up. And they started going in. They didn't have to do much in the way of battle, because these were pretty much defenseless cities at that time.
Right.
So even Damascus, the great city of Damascus, was surrendered by John of Damascus's grandfather in 635 without a shot, without any bloodshed, because they saw that these forces were much greater than what they had, and they wanted peace. So a much different story evolves or comes out as you look at these historical sources from that time.
Yeah, I remember one of the things I remember reading is the fact that Muhammad sort of got all of the Arabs on one page, all the tribes on the same page. But the problem with that is they couldn't fight each other anymore. They couldn't rob each other anymore. So they had to go and rob other people.
Right.
And that's how Islam started spreading.
Right. And you think of the word Hijra, which is, going back to 622, the escape of Muhammad. Well, Hijra means emigration, movement outward. And what were the people doing? They were emigrating out of this land where they didn't have any means of helping themselves or any funds, and they were going and emigrating to the Northland, where they had more opportunities for funds.
Right. I'd like to discuss some of the early theological and philosophical discussions in Islam that have an effect on Islam today. And because there were theological discussions that I think a lot of people don't know about, because I didn't know about.
Oh, yeah.
For instance, works versus faith.
Well, let me outline. During the first 100 years, mm-hmm, you had, because that's when there was a lot of activity, this group, which was organizing itself And I believe that it organized itself under these early leaders, especially a leader named Abdul-Malik, a name to remember. He was the caliph between 685 to 705. He was the boss of John of Damascus. John of Damascus was a strong Christian, but because he was a knowledgeable man, and the Arabs, when they moved in that area, they didn't know anything about government. They needed these Byzantine administrators to run the show, to collect the taxes, and that's what John did. He was a chief financial officer of this empire. So they needed these different people, but they were influenced by different ideas. And some of these ideas were ones that any new religion or coming onto the scene faced. One, works versus faith.
Right.
How do you get to God? Free will versus predestination. Created versus eternal. And they're talking about the Quran. Was
right.
it always here or not? Works versus faith is very interesting because it's the first major controversy. Basically, it was saying that you have human responsibility, so are we responsible for our sins and therefore we need to do something about them? Or is it all by faith? We have to believe that God will save us and it's all by His power. And there's a struggle between those who said, no, we've got our own responsibilities. We've got to be responsible for our sins. And one of the controversies at that time was that the leaders were sinning. They were doing whatever they wanted. They were elaborate sins at that time. And the Qadijites were saying they needed to be punished for this. So this was one of the big struggles. And today we have that coming out in the form of the idea that God is absolute, that Allah is absolute. The ones who won, the ones who said, it's all by faith, it's all by Allah's will. His will is everything. Nothing else matters. So there is that one by works versus faith. The other one is probably more influential, free will versus predestination. We all know what that means, that one group called the Qadirites said that man possessed qadar, or power, and therefore he had the responsibility to do what was right, and he would be judged by that. The others, the Jebrites, or the traditionalites, said that, God is all-powerful, and he is arbitrary. His power is unpredictable. He can do whatever he wants.
Right, so God is not good because he's God. If he does something, it's good because Allah did it. Is that
right.
Sort of the way of looking at it? Instead of, for instance, like, we would say that God can't do anything that's not good because good is part of his nature. So if he does something, he did it because it's good.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in Islam, God isn't good. God is sort of like amoral. If he does something, it's good because he did it.
If
God decided that today murder was okay, then murder's okay. If he decided that rape was okay, then rape is okay. Whatever God says is okay.
Right, because Islam focuses on the will of God, which leads us to power. Everything is centered in power.
Right.
And that's why Islam is so much about power, not love, not really submission. They say that, you know, Islam means submission to
right.
Allah. But really, thereafter, Islam is set up by its whole root process to deal with power, to look at Allah as pure will, pure power. And then the last one, dealing with the Quran, which was very interesting because some wanted to say, well, the Quran is so perfect, it must also be uncreated. Well, if you have something else that is uncreated, then you have another God, another entity that is there besides Allah and the Quran. And logically, you cannot have that. So that was a problem for those who said, no, the Mu'tazilites were the ones who were saying that the Quran was the created word of God. It's from the eternal word of God, the speech of God, the mind of God, but the individual Quran that you write down, well, that's just a created thing. Well, the other side that was saying that the Quran is eternal, even that written word that a man would write was the eternal word of Allah, so you could not destroy that. You could not do anything to that. You had to respect it.
Right.
And that's one reason why they hold the Quran so highly today, because there is that whole sense that this is the uncreated word of Allah.
Right.
And it has to have a certain respect.
One thing I do want to touch on is mention Al-Ghazi.
Okay.
I hope I'm pronouncing his name correct. And the impact he's had on Islam then and now.
Okay. Al-Ghazali was one of the chief philosophers. And there's a period where you had a number of important philosophers who interpreted Aristotle. You had Ibn Rushd. You had Avicenna. But Al-Ghazali was one of the last ones. He was an Asharite. This was a position of where it came from responsibility, and then the Asharites kind of came to a neutral position where they resolved certain issues, but they were still dependent on reason to an extent. Well, Al-Ghazali, as he became more and more of a Sufi, he came to the point of saying, well, reason philosophy is inconsequential. It cannot tell us the truth. It's all man trying to search for truth, so it is unknowable. What we have to do is go back to the Quran. The Quran is the only thing that we need. So in 1111, when he died, that was the early 12th century, because of his influence, and it was so great at that time, he pretty much said that all philosophy, all man's thinking, is rotten to the core. We've got to go back to the Quran. Well, there were a lot of people who followed that. In fact, one of the books that's very important, Robert Riley, The Closing of the Muslim Mind, really focuses on this. And he says how intellectual suicide created the modern Islamist crisis. So he goes back to Al-Ghazali, goes through his philosophy, and shows how this was the death knell of Islamic philosophical thought. It was forbidden after that. So even today, Muslims are constantly said or told when they ask questions, that is bid'ah, that's forbidden. You're not supposed to think about those things. Why? Because you're only supposed to focus on the Quran and on the will of God, the will of Allah. And so they're afraid to ask the questions that they should be asking. And that has really influenced the whole culture of Islam. So from that time, even though they had a golden age before that, where they borrowed a lot,
right.
You know, they got the math, the numbers, what we call the Arabic numbers, they really came from India. The concept of the zero, that came from Indian philosophy. But they were all around the world at that time, and they were pulling these ideas together. They were making advances in medicine. They were making advances in astronomy. And it's interesting that a lot of these who were making advances were first-generation converts who were raised
right.
in Christianity
right.
and Judaism, but they were converts to Islam, and Persians. A lot of the philosophers were Persians, not Arabs. But during this time, there was an interchange of ideas, a great borrowing, but then that came to a halt. And what do you have from that point today in the Muslim world? You don't have those advances.
Right.
They have fallen behind. Muslims themselves have pointed to this time after time in article after article, showing that Islam needs to wake up because they have hurt themselves tremendously in this modern world. What do they have left? The search for power.
Right. And I remember reading about the fact that because of this, we don't see any patents being developed in Muslim countries, or very few. We don't see many books being written, unless they are religious books. We don't see new technology springing up, because all these things are happening in the West, and a lot of that has to do with Al-Ghazi and his influence.
Right, and that closing in the Muslim mind. And fortunately, there are Muslims who are coming over to the West. They're getting educated. They're learning new things. And they're breaking out of that. But it's interesting that, and one of my colleagues said this, and he was very serious. He was out of a heart of compassion. He said, you know, I've spent most of my life ministering to Muslims in the Middle East. And it's interesting that the Muslim who is known as the good, devout Muslim, the one who is strongest in his following of the Quran, often is a bad man, bad person, an evil person, because of what they do, because they think that Allah has said for them to do this. On the other hand, the one who is thought to be a moderate Muslim or a cultural Muslim, is often a good Muslim, a good friend, one who reaches out, one who accepts you.
Right.
So it's interesting that you have that dichotomy. Why? Because I think that at the base of Islam, there is fear. And so what I tell my students is that, and this I have found out with my Muslim friends, I have a number of Muslim friends that I really enjoy. They're great people. It's Islam, the religion, the background, the view of God itself, that is problematic,
right?
Not the people. We need to love the people,
right?
But we need to be very cautious about Islam itself.
Right. And that's going to bring me to my last question. We only have a couple minutes left, but the early history of Islam, how does that relate to the violence that we see around the world today? How does that relate to terrorism?
Okay. Well, you have an outflow of the consequences of that thought. And just to continue with Al-Ghazali and what happened, and what Robert Riley documents so well in his book, The Closing of the Muslim Mind, ideas have consequences. Bad ideas have bad consequences. And because Islam has focused on God as pure will, not as love, but pure will, there is this need for power. Why? Because there's also underlying all that a fear of who God is, a fear of what will happen, a fear of eternal consequences for the person unless they submit fully. But when you look at that word submission, Islam means submission. Now, they want to say that Islam means peace.
Right.
Well, Islam is a religion of peace. Well, it's true that the root, and because it's a Semitic language and you have consonants, the S-L-M for Islam or Salam, peace, is the root is S-L-M. There is a great difference in the connotation of those words, the actual use of those words. It's kind of like in English, we have a similar thing. If you take the French-derived word corps, for Marine Corps, C-O-R-P-S, we pronounce it without the S, that's a body of Marines. A body of live people. But if you add an E on that, you have a corpse, a dead body. Still a body. It still has that reference point, but they're very different things. A live body or a dead body. And I see that being similar with Islam and Salam. Islam means submission. Submission to that God of will, that pure power that they are submitting to, often out of fear. Yes, they say, if the time comes when every nation is under the dominion of Islam, then there will be peace.
Right.
But there's not peace before that, because they are told by the Quran to go out and conquer all these nations for Allah, because they are told also that until that time, there will not be peace. So that's what we have to deal with today, and that started way back in the 7th century.
Well, that will bring us to the end of the show. Dr. Janassi, thanks for being on the show talking with us here today on the title, A Critical Look at Early Islam. You're to join me again next time. And until then, goodbye and God bless.
You can find out more about Giving an Answer as well as listen to other episodes by visiting us online at www.givinganswer.org. Oh,